Decades after it was launched, NASA's Voyager 1 probe is still making news. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft were launched in the 1970s.
In the 1980s, they passed close by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, making significant discoveries along the way. Now, Voyager 1 is sending back information suggesting that it is reaching the edge of the solar system.
It's already far beyond any planet, and it's about to leave the space that is influenced by the energy from the sun. Dr. Ed Stone is chief scientist of the Voyager space program. He has been since the beginning, and he describes the solar system as a kind of a bubble whose size is defined by solar winds propelled outward from the sun. This is a spacecraft that passed the last planet in the solar system more than a couple of decades ago, but is still within the solar system as you understand it.
It's still inside the solar bubble. That's correct. We're still bathed by the same solar wind that we have been for the last 30-some years. But once we leave the bubble, we will be, for the first time, surrounded by winds that came from the explosion of other stars.
When this was launched in the 1970s, did you anticipate the spacecraft lasting long enough that it would actually leave the solar system?
Well, we had hoped that, in fact, it would, and part of the original design of the mission was an interstellar phase, but, of course, none of us knew exactly how large the bubble was that we were inside, so we didn't know whether the spacecraft could last as long as it has. When the two Voyagers were launched in 1977, the space age itself was only 20 years old, so there was no evidence or experience that would suggest that they could last as long as they have.
Oh, now, wait a minute. You're saying that up until now, no one has known exactly how big the solar system is as you define it, the area that is covered by the solar wind.
That's correct. We have only had estimates, so we didn't know whether we were inside of a smaller or larger heliosphere. And that's because the size of the bubble is determined by this pressure of the wind blowing outward, pushing against the wind outside. And we don't know exactly, although we know a lot more today than we did 20 years ago, exactly how much pressure there is outside pushing back.
Okay, so just in terms of miles, if you can give me a figure, if we think of the solar system as this giant ball with the sun as a point at the center of it, how big a cross is it?
It's a comet-shaped object, so we're headed toward the nose of the comet. Voyager 1 now is 11 billion miles from the sun, and my expectation that is that it's probably at most another billion miles, and may in fact be only a few hundred million miles before we reach the edge of the bubble. We're getting very close now.
I'm just imagining an interstate road sign, 1 billion miles to go.
Right. That's 3 years for Voyager 1, 1 billion miles every 3 years.
And when you say it's comet-shaped and you're heading toward the nose of the comet, you're saying that 11, 12 billion miles, give or take, is the closest exit from the solar system. If you'd gone the other direction, it'd be much farther.
That is exactly correct. If we'd gone down the tail, it would be a very long journey to get outside into interstellar space.
And, of course, there is just immeasurable distances beyond the solar system.
Yes, that's correct. The two Voyager spacecraft will be orbiting the center of our galaxy, but very distant from any other object in the galaxy.
Is this boundary line that you seem to be approaching the last thing of interest that you can imagine Voyager encountering before it goes out of contact or goes out of service?
We want to explore interstellar space itself. We have some ideas of what's out there, but from observations from Earth, we believe that we're in a cloud of material that was ejected by the explosion of a series of supernova about 5 to 10, 15 million years ago, very near the sun, and that we will be embedded in the material from those giant explosions. And the magnetic field, which was swept up by the shells of material ejected by those exploding stars. So we're very interested in learning more precisely what's really outside of the bubble pressing back inward.
So you want to get out into interstellar space. Is it strange at all to think of the fact that you are exploring the farthest reaches of the solar system and trying to go beyond with the very latest in 1970s technology?
Yes, that's kind of peculiar that, in fact, we have instruments that were developed in spacecraft that was developed in the early 70s. The computers on board this spacecraft, it's a totally automated spacecraft. The computers have 8,000 words of memory.
That's, well, nothing.
Yes, it's nothing.
I mean, I'm sure many people have a smartphone that has far more memory than that
today. Oh, yes. They're measured in, you know, billions of words, not thousands.
Would you put any different equipment, obviously be better equipment, but would you ask for any different capabilities for this spacecraft if you were sending it off today on the same mission?
We would certainly have more up-to-date instruments, which are more sensitive. We would want to measure more of the energetic particles than we can. We did not cover all of the interesting energies, as it turns out. We can only infer some of what's out there, even with the instruments on Voyager. And there are many other observations with modern spectrometers that we could make of the environment out there that we can't make with Voyager.
What powers Voyager?
It's powered by the natural radioactive decay of plutonium-238 and thermocouples bolted to this heat source. A very simple, robust power supply. The radioactive decay half-life is 88 years, and that's one reason why the spacecraft are still working, is because we have a very long life battery, if you like. But we do know that our power level drops by 4 watts every year, and so we have to systematically turn things off one at a time. About the year 2020, we'll have to turn off one of the science instruments, and by 2025, we'll have to have all the science instruments off, and that will be the end of the mission.
So you have been tracking this spacecraft for coming up on 35 years now.
That's right, and we have our 35th anniversary of launch in 2012, and we still have a great journey to go.
You ever get bored waiting on it to reach the next thing?
Well, because we're exploring a part of space nothing has been before, every day we look at the data and we realize that it's even more interesting than we had imagined. That's one of the lessons from the Voyager mission, is that no matter what you think you know, what there is to learn is even more interesting.
Well, Dr. Stone, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Ed Stone is the chief scientist on the Voyager space program. Something about that music that just makes you want to talk that way. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
We're reaching the end of a deeply mixed year for the U.S. economy. The unemployment rate ends the year at its lowest point since 2009, yet still very high, 8.6%. Many of the unemployed have paid the bills only by borrowing from family and friends, as we're hearing elsewhere in this program. Yet it was a year of economic growth, and for some people, businesses, and ideas, it was a breakthrough year. We're going to highlight some of them in a series of stories called A Good Year. It has, for example, been a good year for the digital cloud. Companies have advertised this concept in which you store your information in distant data centers.
This is the iPhone 4S with iCloud.
Powered by Amazon's cloud technology.
To the cloud with Windows Live to create and share anywhere.
So advertisers talk about it, but it can be a struggle to understand what the cloud really is. NPR's Wendy Kaufman went to look for it.
Clouds are often ethereal and beautiful, but this one has a lot of concrete and security.
This is a ballistics-grade door, so you could feel the weight of it, and so we'll open the door, and then we'll pass through. Now, this
David Sabe, the owner here, is ushering me into a spotless Seattle-area facility the size of 9 football fields. It's crammed full of racks and racks of powerful servers, essentially sophisticated computers that serve up information to other computers. There are lots of blinking lights and wires everywhere.
Some of the compute cycles that are going on here could be providing a product for someone in Florida to Southern California to Alaska. So that's what a cloud looks like.
Well, sort of. Basically, the cloud is a fancy way of saying the internet. Lots of us have been using Yahoo or Gmail, so our email lives on the cloud, not on our computer. But email was just the beginning. This year, the cloud brought us something we didn't even know we craved, a digital storage locker. Think back to high school, where you stuffed that metal locker with books, homework projects, photos of friends, maybe even some music. But that music and everything else existed in only one physical place. You couldn't really drag that locker around. If you forgot to get something and went home for the day, you could try the "I left it in my locker" excuse. But now, that excuse just won't cut it. Here's why.
If I store my information online in one of these clouds, then it's as if I suddenly have a magic courier that will run and retrieve stuff out of my locker and deliver it to me instantly.
And, says Frank Gillette, an analyst at Forrester Research,
the idea of having this magic courier is remarkable.
The couriers have names like Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and some upstarts like Dropbox. And this year, they ramped up their offerings and marketed them like crazy. They'll deliver ebooks, photos, music, and lots of other things from your cloud-based locker, and they'll make deliveries to almost any digital gadget. But businesses use the cloud differently. For them, the cloud can function a bit like a giant kitchen you can rent. Think of all those servers as ovens. In the past, companies would often build their own kitchens with enough equipment to prepare things they might only need once a month. But now, says Frank Gillette,
they don't have to have their own kitchen, or they don't have to have as big a kitchen.
A company might need one or two ovens or servers just for an hour every week to do its payroll. Or it might need 100 to manage a worldwide network of customer accounts. By using the cloud, companies pay only for the time and equipment they actually use. Businesses can also use the cloud for takeout. For example, instead of building their own accounting system, they can use a pre-made cloud-based one, and the results can be delivered right to their front door.
We literally charge our customers on a per-hour basis for the resources that they're consuming.
Brian Thompson is with a rapidly growing Seattle area company called Tier 3. It helps companies use the cloud.
So we have customers that are spending less than $100 a month, and we have customers that spend close to $100,000 a month.
Whatever the figure, it's often less than a company would spend to do the task on its own, and it's often more convenient. Companies can also rent time to do projects on an almost unimaginable scale. This example comes from Adam Salipsky, a senior official at the part of Amazon.com, which provides cloud services.
We recently had a large pharmaceutical company who's our customer spin up 30,000 virtual servers to do mathematical modeling.
There are very few companies that could afford or even want to manage something that big. In so many ways, 2011 was a banner year for the cloud, and next year's cloud offerings are likely to be even bigger and better. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Families affected by autism face many challenges when it comes to travel, especially navigating airports and riding on planes. A Philadelphia program is bringing families, airport employees, and airlines together to help autistic kids fly more comfortably. From member station WHYY, Mike and Scott has more.
Airports are loud, hectic places. Blaring announcements, glaring lights, and long lines can spell trouble for people with autism. They often can't tolerate noise, bright lights, and close quarters. Moms gathered at Philadelphia International Airport on a recent morning have experienced the effects firsthand.
She was screaming, she was pale, she was having problems breathing.
He didn't understand what was going on. The people thought he was being belligerent, and he wasn't. It was just too much.
Susan Stein and Cecilia Thompson have kids with autism and haven't tried to fly with them since their last terrible experiences. But they are back at the airport to give flying another shot, starting with a practice run.
We do everything from curb to cabin and back.
Philadelphia developmental pediatrician Wendy Ross started the practice program at the Philadelphia airport after a patient had an especially bad experience flying.
She had expected to pre-board with her whole family, and then the airline's rules were that she could only pre-board with one family member. And so she got very anxious and aggressive and was biting her parents and was unable to make that flight home.
Besides making families feel comfortable, Ross wants airline and airport staff to know more about autism. And she starts by talking to them.
So some of the kids are really cognitively delayed, and some of them are really bright, and some of them are more or less affected by new situations. So the way they react really varies by the family and the child.
But the families wait at the check-in counter where they get real boarding passes. TSA officer Robert Reeser explains the first hurdle, getting through security.
No children will have to take their footwear off, and all the adults unfortunately have to.
Everybody seems a bit tense as the group proceeds to security, but all the kids make it through.
It's okay. Everybody has to go first. So far, so good.
Carmela Zelli is preparing her family for a trip to Disneyland in April. Her 11-year-old son, Anthony, is nonverbal and gets agitated easily. She's worried he won't go down the jetway.
Because if he can't see what's in front of him, he gets nervous and then he doesn't like to go.
Zelli is right. Anthony walks all the way down to the plane, then turns around and runs away crying. Flight attendant Dana McHugh says watching the family struggle was a valuable lesson.
Most of all, to have patience and just step back and be aware of the situation.
The other families settle into their seats and are greeted by a United Airlines flight crew.
And ladies and gentlemen from the flight deck, good morning.
The plane doesn't actually go anywhere, so families get off after a snack. They gather their belongings and each kid receives a pin with wings from the airport. Wendy Ross says it's a symbol of their achievement.
Literally, we're helping kids fly, but as a metaphor, you know, travel is so much more than how we get from one place to another. It's really how we experience opportunity.
And even though one boy wasn't able to board the plane this time, Ross says she now knows what to practice with him to get him to Disneyland. For NPR News, I'm Maiken Scott in Philadelphia.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, having to tackle the emotional and psychological toll of being transgendered is difficult. This is especially true for adolescents. We'll talk with a doctor who specializes in treating transgendered adolescents about a controversial medication that halts puberty. That's in just a few minutes. But first, feeding America's poor during the holidays. The Census Bureau estimates that nearly 50 million Americans are now living below the poverty line. And some food banks across the nation are reporting a sizable drop in food and cash donations, just as the need is growing. Here to talk more about how food banks are managing this are Amy Besunder. She's executive director of North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank. It's based in Seattle. Also with us is Ross Fraser. He's the spokesperson for Feeding America, which is one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Amy, let me start with you. We've been hearing from all over the country that food bank donations are down. How are things looking in Seattle?
Well, across the board, food banks in Seattle are reporting a 30% decrease in both cash and food donations while reporting increases in client need. Personally, at the North Helpline, we've seen over a 50% increase in client base over the last 2 years. And some of the people who used to be donors or provide food to us on a regular basis are now coming to us as clients.
What other different kind of people are you seeing this year? I saw a number somewhere that said that more people are employed that are coming for food help this year than are homeless.
We are seeing more families coming to us, and often there is at least one working parent within those families. However, their employment is tenuous. It may be part-time employment. They may be supporting their spouse as well as children on a single income. And Seattle is quite an expensive city, and attempting to support a family on a single income is quite a challenge here.
Ross, let me bring you into the conversation. Your Feeding America has more than 200 food bank members nationwide. What are you hearing from them? Are donations dwindling for them as well?
Yes. What we are in is what we call a perfect storm. Demand is up. It's up 46% in just the last 4 years. 4 years ago, we were feeding 25 million people a year. We are now feeding 37 million people a year. The good news is we have found more food. We were moving 2 billion pounds of food, and that's billion with a B. Now we are providing more than 3 billion pounds of food a year. But it's not enough. And I will tell you, many of our food banks, as Amy just referenced, will tell you that they're operating in disaster mode. So many people who are unemployed or underemployed just cannot make ends meet and have to show up for a bag of groceries or their family won't eat.
I'm wondering, Ross, if there is a particular group of people who is more impacted by the shortages this year.
Absolutely. I put a list together of my top 10 hunger lists. I'll just give you a couple of things. Right now, 1 in 3 Latino children in this country are receiving food from Feeding America. 1 in 4 African-American households is food insecure. 1 in 5 children is food insecure. One in six Americans are food insecure, and one in seven Americans are receiving food stamps. So we know it disproportionately affects African Americans and Hispanics, and we're looking to change that. We've got to turn that around.
Ross, I'm curious, are you hearing from your members that they're worried about having to turn people away this year?
Well, yes. I had a very sad story out of Fort Smith, Arkansas, just recently at Thanksgiving time. They had 100 turkeys to give away, and 400 people showed up for the turkeys. So they had to make a decision that if you were there representing the family of four or more people, you got a turkey. If you didn't, if you had a smaller family, it was just you, you didn't get a turkey.
We had to employ a similar system with 850 families coming through our door. And so we had about 400 turkeys and also had to make a choice in terms of family size. And that's a really difficult decision to make. We certainly had a lot of tears and a lot of wringing of hands on the part of our clients who were hoping to provide a holiday meal to their families.
Amy, this is 850 people coming through a week?
That's correct.
It can't be easy for the providers to see that either. Ross, I'm curious, where are your donations coming from this year? Is it the same people that have been giving money annually, or is there a different group? Because, as Amy said, some of those who were donors are now clients.
Well, I will tell you, there is good news. And because we're the national office for most of the food banks in the country, our donor base is a little different. So what the good news is that we have so many corporations now coming forward to help us who were not involved in hunger relief previously, particularly financial institutions. Bank of America recently gave us $1 million. Other corporate donors have stepped up to the plate. So our donations from large donors have increased. Our biggest problem, what has happened to us, is that food coming from the federal government through the USDA is a significant chunk of the food that we move. Mm-hmm. It's food that they get from the agricultural community. So it's produce, fruits, vegetables, poultry, eggs,
milk. In other words, it's perishable.
It's perishable, but it's high-quality food. 2 years ago, our network received about $704 million worth of food through the USDA. Now, this year, 2011, that is reduced to $467 million. So we've had to make up for that. So we have to go out and find more food. We have to purchase food, which we didn't do on a large scale 5 or 10 years ago, and having to look for other sources for food.
Let me jump in here for a moment and say, if you're just joining us, I'm Allison Keyes, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're discussing hunger in America and the challenges some food banks are facing this holiday season. With us is Amy Basunder of the Seattle-based North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank, and Ross Fraser of Feeding America, one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. Amy, you're on the ground in Seattle, and I know your organization gets a little bit less than a quarter of its food from Feeding America warehouses. What kind of things have you had to do to adjust what you're able to give people that are coming to you for help? Are you having to give them lesser amounts of food? Are you having to give them different kinds of food?
Unfortunately, we have had to reduce the amount of food that we give to each client who comes through our doors. The poundage has decreased by 10 pounds of food per individual. So we used to give out an average of 30 pounds of food per week to each of our clients, and now we're giving out about 20 pounds of food per week. And so clients are really having to stretch the resources that are available to them. And many of our clients have reported that there are days where they are experiencing actual hunger.
And you've also had to cut back on being able to give people meat, is that right?
Protein is one of the key items that we are seeing our stream dwindle out on. So there have been, for the first time in the years that I had been at the food bank, we have operated a food bank without having the option to offer meat to clients. And that happened in October, and it was quite an alarming experience to open the food bank and have to tell people that we weren't going to be able to offer a completely balanced grocery selection that day.
I was curious, as your clients don't have any other resources except for the food bank if you're unable to help them with proteins, is that right?
That's essentially correct. Food banks serve the communities they exist within. And so Our clients can't seek out another community for food. They're reliant on us to be able to provide balanced groceries to their families.
Ross, I wonder, are you hearing that things are worse in some parts of the country than others from your 200 members, or is it pretty much all across the board?
Yeah, yes, it is bad across the board. There are particular areas of the country where things are terrible. Things are terrible in Florida, where the real estate market has collapsed. Ohio has lost a lot of businesses. A lot of factories have moved out. I had a heartbreaking conversation with the people in Oklahoma. Their unemployment is not particularly high, but so many people have low-wage jobs in Oklahoma. So when you talk about unemployment, that gives you a false impression. Oh, things are okay in Oklahoma. Well, they're not if everyone's making minimum wage or a significant number of people are. But many of our clients receive SNAP, which is formerly known as food stamps. Mm-hmm. SNAP is supplemental, and most people, most families' food stamps run out by the middle of the month. So if we can't help them, there is nowhere else for them to turn. When our pantries are bare, these families have nowhere else to go, and that's just heartbreaking.
And Amy, let me ask you, you're on the ground. Do you need volunteers? Say people in Seattle could come knock on your door tomorrow. If they don't have cash to give, is there something else they can do to help you?
Absolutely. We utilize over 200 volunteers each week to operate our food bank. It runs the course of sorting food, actually distributing food, delivering food to our homebound and elderly clients. We need help. And so we always appreciate our volunteers coming forward and making sure that their neighbors in need are cared for.
Ross, let me just ask you one final question. There are some signs that the economy is beginning to recover. Is there a light at the end of this tunnel?
There is a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's far away. And I will tell you, for people who are at the low end of the economic system structure in this country, when the economy gets better, the people at the bottom are always the last people to benefit. So we, unemployment has been about 9% for a long, long time. We are looking for more food and we're looking for more money because we know that there is going to be tremendous need for the foreseeable future.
Ross Fraser is a spokesperson for Feeding America, which is one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. It has more than 200 food bank members nationwide. He joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. And Amy Besunder is executive director of North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank in Seattle. She joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Perhaps more than any other major professional sports league in this country, the National Basketball Association is star-driven, and yesterday the stars did not disappoint. A Christmas slate of season-opening games featured the electric play of the league's most valuable player, Derrick Rose, and the NBA's top scorer, Kevin Durant, and this guy named LeBron James as well. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman monitored as much as he could of 13 hours of NBA action, and he joins me now. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Linda.
So what did you learn from the first five games of this lockout-shortened season?
I learned once again why NBA Commissioner David Stern often flashes that Cheshire Cat grin, even when fans were hating his league for nearly canceling the season because of a labor dispute. Stern knows what we saw again yesterday, the power to mend fans' hurt feelings with masterful performances on the court. You know, we have all-star forward Carmelo Anthony scoring 37 points and leading the New York Knicks to a thrilling two-point win over Boston. We have LeBron James scoring 37 as the Heat humiliated the defending champion Dallas Mavericks. On the day, the Mavericks raised their championship banner from last season. We have Derrick Rose capping off a Chicago rally. The Bulls were down 11 against the LA Lakers with less than 4 minutes to play, and then Rose hits the winning shot with seconds left on the clock. We have Kevin Durant scoring 30 points to lead Oklahoma City. And the nightcap, those new-look LA Clippers easily beat Golden State with big help from their snazzy new point guard Chris Paul. He had 20 points points and 9 assists.
Okay, so it's early in the season, but are you prepared to draw any conclusions about what you saw yesterday?
Well, you know, of course, every game you have to preface with, it was only the first game. And some of these teams may want to lean on that more than others. For example, the Lakers. They can say, well, we almost beat a Chicago team that's considered one of the Eastern Conference elite. We're still adjusting to the loss of one of our key players, Lamar Odom, who was traded to Dallas. And we didn't have our starting center, Andrew Bynum. He's serving a 4-game suspension to start out the season. Same for the Boston Celtics, who, like the Lakers, they're said to be ready for a down year because they're old. The Celtics didn't have their top player, Paul Pierce. He's out with a heel injury, and they still almost beat those star-studded Knicks. Now, on the other hand, you've got the two teams picked by many to be in the finals, Miami and Oklahoma City. They look ready for that championship round now. For them, it was like, yeah, it was just game one, and we sure want to keep playing like that.
But still, it sounds like the Heat were the big deal of the opener.
Yeah, they made a big statement. They beat Dallas in Dallas by 11, but Miami led by more than 30 points at times. They thoroughly dominated the Mavs. The entire team was so sharp on defense. LeBron James was at his all-court best, scoring, passing, defending. You and I talked Friday about James, how he'd been working on his game. He added some new skills down close to the basket, and he showed off some of that.
What about the defending champions? Any talk of a repeat performance?
Well, there's less of it after yesterday. As I mentioned before the game, Dallas raised its championship banner, and one snarky commentator said at halftime, maybe they should take it down. They looked unprepared, basically, and they really seemed to miss two key players from last year who signed with other teams. Guard J.J. Barea, he was so effective with his darting drives to the hoop and his ability to break down defenses. And 7-foot center Tyson Chandler, he was so dominant around the basket for the Mavs, especially on defense. They could have used those guys yesterday and going forward.
Tom, thanks very much.
You bet.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman.